listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Edward Jaraday began covering events in Afghanistan several months before the Soviet invasion in 1979 as a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. News and World Report, and the McNeil Era NewsHour. He's written about his three decades of experience in Afghanistan in his latest book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. It's published by Chelsea Green, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much. Your second book
on Afghanistan.
Second.
You arrived in 1979. Was there even any sense that the Soviet Union was going to invade at that point?
Not really. They were actually supporting the local government, which was a communist government. But the civil war had already begun, actually broke out in the summer of 1978. And I'd just gone there to investigate as a young freelance foreign correspondent based in Paris to investigate what appeared to be a brewing war in Afghanistan.
And you had to convince your editor at the Christian Science Monitor to let you go?
No, I only got hired by the Monitor right after that, when the Soviets invaded. But it was...
Oh, suddenly it became an important place.
Absolutely.
And this is one of the problems we have with journalism in general, isn't it? A place is absolutely uninteresting until something terrible happens, but it's interesting even before and after.
Absolutely. And the good thing about the Christian Science Monitor was that my editors insisted that we cover it consistently throughout the 1980s and beyond. And, you know, every so often my editor would say, Ed, isn't it time to go back? So I would do that.
Now, why was the Soviet government so interested in taking over Afghanistan? They pretty much controlled all of Central Asia at that point.
Well, there were a variety of reasons. One was perhaps the fact that the communist regime, was in the process of being undermined and, you know, it would have collapsed. Secondly, Ayatollah Khomeini had just come into power in neighboring Iran. I think the last thing the Soviets wanted was to have another Islamic regime on their border. And also opportunistic, they thought they could move an old Tsarist dream of having a port in the warm water seas of the Indian Ocean.
Hadn't they read about all of the attempts to conquer Afghanistan in the past?
Well, you know, that's the amazing thing with Afghanistan. No matter who you are, you would think that you would look back in history, whether it's going back to the 19th century or even beyond, or even looking back, you know, to the 80s.
Well, isn't that one of the problems we have with Afghanistan? This is a country that has this rich history and has a rich history in relation to other countries. And yet, I suspect... most people outside of Afghanistan know as little about the country now as they did at that time.
Yes. Robert Byron, a British writer during the 1930s, said, after coming in from Iran, said, "At last, a country without an inferiority complex." And that's the thing about Afghanistan. It's a very diverse country, incredibly hospitable people, but also people who resent outsiders who overstay their stay.
But then the country became the site of a proxy war between the United States and the USSR. Was the United States support for the Mujahideen noticeable while you were there?
Not before the Soviets invaded, although support had just begun. Obviously, after that, during the 1980s, it became very strong. But what the Americans, what the CIA was doing, was working very closely with ISI, which is the Pakistani Military Intelligence Organization, who basically call the shots.
So there really were three countries involved.
Oh, there are a host of countries involved, the U.S., Iran, China, the West. You can just go down to Saudi Arabia. And then freelance groups such as Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, who actually came in initially as a humanitarian.
Well, Charlie Wilson's war... makes him into a hero for getting involved in this situation. Was he being heroic? And what was the CIA? How big a footprint did the CIA have?
The CIA relied massively on the Pakistanis to provide them with intelligence. And of course, the Pakistanis had their own agenda, which had very little to do with the U.S. agenda. When it came to bin Laden, he was one of many assets of the CIA who we supported logistically. At that time, he was an Islamic legionary amongst many, and he changed his support from humanitarian to more weapons and financial support as the war developed in the 1980s.
Why did the United States feel that keeping the Soviets out of Afghanistan was in our national interest?
It was really a mean strategy, if you like. It was to give the Soviets their own Vietnam. That was what Brzezinski started, what we continued with. I think there was,
it seems surprising to have occurred during the Carter administration.
It started out with the Carter administration and then continued under Reagan. But the problem was there was a very poor understanding of Afghanistan.
Well, many people have said that this was a turning point for the Soviet Union, or a tipping point, a country that had a troubled economy and things were falling apart anyway. Do you think that this is what really led finally to the end of the Soviet Union?
It became financially impossible, and a lot of Afghans will very proudly tell you it's because of them that the Soviet Union collapsed, not just Solidar Notch in Poland. But the Soviets realized it was a pointless war. They were achieving nothing. They'd lost over 15,000, possibly 20,000 troops, and it was costing them a fortune, and they then decided to pull out.
And here we are. It's costing us a fortune too, isn't it?
To me, it's a complete replay, but even worse, perhaps, of what happened in the 1980s, because we had, and we have, the intelligence, the information at hand that should have warned us. But we've done one mistake after another with regard to Afghanistan, and started a very unnecessary war, I think.
My guest is Edward Girardet, G-I-R-A-R-D-E-T. His book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan. It's published by Chelsea Green. You begin the book with the story that leads to your title.
Killing the Cranes, yes. I was seeing a very old friend of mine who had been severely wounded in the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the leading northern commander, by two al-Qaeda operatives. And this was in the early spring of 2004. We were talking about Afghanistan, the future, the trauma of so many years of war. And as we walked outside after a rather depressing conversation, we looked up at the night sky around Kabul. And he said, you know, for me, the end of March was always the time when you couldn't hear the sound of your voice for the migrating cranes. And he was referring to the Siberian cranes that traditionally would fly from the wetlands of the south back to Siberia in March. And he said, since being here, I've not heard a single crane. And then he sort of touched my arm and said, have we even killed all the cranes? And when I heard that, I thought, that's a book title. You
know. Had they killed the cranes, or were the cranes just simply avoiding a place
we don't know.
Nobody should have been going.
We don't know that they're certainly an endangered species.
Many of our friends in Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, like Osama bin Laden or Jalaluddin Haqqani, eventually turned on us. Why and when did so many of the Mujahideen decide that we were actually the enemy?
Well, Haqqani was actually an extremely good commander, but we also supported people like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a fundamentalist who the Pakistanis loved and who murdered thousands of people, including Afghan moderates. But we felt that, or the U.S. felt, the CIA felt, that these were the most effective commanders, and that was certainly not the case.
Well, after the Soviets were ejected from the country, Hekmatyar, who was annoyed that he wasn't being asked to lead the government, just kept on shelling Kabul. Was the United States still supporting him at that time?
No. But by then, the U.S. had dropped Afghanistan like a hot potato, which was another big mistake. They should have somehow stayed with it, not militarily, but certainly to try and avoid a civil war.
Well, you traveled with Hezbollah, Gulbuddin, which was founded by Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
I made the point of traveling as much as possible with different groups, because one thing you learn very quickly in Afghanistan is that when you see one particular region, it does not represent Afghanistan. It represents that particular region. So you really had to make an effort to travel with the Baluch in the south, with Pashtuns in the east, with Tajiks in the north. And that's the only way you could really put together a credible picture of what was going on in Afghanistan.
Do you like the idea of embedded journalists?
No, I didn't cover Vietnam. I was too young for Vietnam. But the whole concept at the time was that as a journalist, you could cover the war, get up in the morning, go out with a military plane, cover something somewhere, come back in the evening. Now you can't do that. You have to embed contractually with ISAF, with the U.S. forces.
Did you ever meet Osama bin Laden?
I came across him. I didn't know at the time who he was. At the end of the 1980s, was actually the week of the Soviet departure from Afghanistan.
Well, he was a striking figure, wasn't he?
Very tall, very arrogant. And he wanted to know what I was doing there and claimed that this was not my jihad. And we had this rather curious conversation for about 45 minutes. I just regarded him as being one of the Arab Islamic legionnaires there. I didn't know who he was at the time.
Now, this had to all have been rather dangerous for you as an outsider. At one point, didn't the American consul tell you that Hekmatyar was trying to have you killed?
Yeah, Hekmatyar was very angry at my reporting at the time, and which was also being replicated by the BBC World Service and Dari and Pashto and by VOA, Voice of America. So whatever you wrote would get out there the next day to ordinary Afghans. And indeed, you know, Hekmatyar had threatened me. I went to see him with two other journalists and said, Mr. Hekmatyar, I believe that you're trying to kill me. And he said, no, have some tea.
But you didn't believe him.
No, I didn't believe him. He'd killed enough people, and they, including journalists.
Isn't he still there as a potential threat?
He's our monster, and he's now one of the key insurgent politicians in Afghanistan fighting U.S. and NATO forces.
Now, you weren't only in Afghanistan during these years, the 30 years you write about. Is that just the way of being a journalist, or did you feel trapped in just covering Afghanistan?
I did in a way because I adored the country, but there were two or three points when I thought enough. But I was also covering wars, humanitarian crises in Africa, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia.
And you reported on the massacre in Kerala in 1980 for the Christian Science Monitor.
Yeah, this is a massacre by communist troops and police with Soviet advisors in April 1979, and over 1,100 men and boys were massacred, machine gunned down, for supporting the Mujahideen.
Really?
Yeah, it was a horrendous massacre, yeah.
We often think of our Afghanistan policy today as linked to whatever's happening in Pakistan. Over the years, we would check in with Sarah Chase, who was stationed in Kandahar, and every time I'd ask her about U.S. policy, she would then, or the Taliban, she would then switch to talking about Pakistan as the puppet master. Some people said she was overstating the case. Is Pakistan really, has it been the puppet master?
I don't think she was overstating. It was and still is the puppet master in many ways. They've always sought to control Afghanistan, and including the Taliban, because right up to 9/11 and October 7th when the bombing began, the Pakistanis were massively supporting the Taliban, as were the Saudi Arabians, as were Al-Qaeda.
And I guess we shouldn't be surprised that Osama bin Laden was found and killed in a compound in Abbottabad, a city that's considered the seat of the Pakistani military and intelligence establishment. Were you surprised?
No, not at all, because despite denials, I think the Islamabad government probably was right in saying they didn't know about it, but certainly components of ISI did.
I get the sense that in the case of the Pakistani government, one hand doesn't know what the other one is doing.
Well, ISI, this military intelligence, is extremely powerful, and any politician who dares stand up to ISI tends to get killed.
But it's also because of their concerns with India. So Afghanistan becomes a way of engaging in a proxy war with India, even though India hasn't sent troops there?
India is their principal concern. What they want is, like during the Soviet war, the Indians were also involved with Afghanistan. Now the Indians are becoming major donors for Afghanistan, and the last thing the Pakistanis want is Indian influence over Afghanistan.
Well, since this is something that seems to be intractable under current circumstances, can't India and Pakistan just work it out and say, okay, we're going to leave Afghanistan alone and worry about...
That's the big problem. And the funny thing is that amongst young people, urban-educated Pakistanis, they love India in the sense... I mean, MTV is the biggest influence on Pakistan. They all are influenced by Bollywood, the Indian movies, Indian music. And you really wonder, why is there a conflict? Is this being perpetrated by an older generation?
My guest is Edward Girardet. His latest book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. It's published by Chelsea Green. Stay with us for more. We're back with Edward Girardet. His book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Sebastian Younger calls it a truly remarkable book about a completely misunderstood country. It is published by Chelsea Green. Why is it misunderstood? I would think that anyone involved in intelligence would have seen that we were pursuing some policies that were bound to cause a blowback, as one person has described them. We were supporting people who ultimately were going to become our enemies. Were they unaware of it?
No, that they were perfectly aware of it. And what was interesting was that there were a number of CIA operatives, a number of State Department, such as Ed McWilliams, who was warned the U.S., warned Washington in the late 1980s not to continue with the support for these fundamentalists because they would come back to haunt us. And he was ignored and sidelined.
So why do you think we ignored them? Because we wanted to hear only what we wanted to hear?
I think we did, yeah. It had run too long. It was too complicated. It was easier to work with the Pakistanis. But, you know, every aid relief worker who worked in Afghanistan, every journalist who came back, saw what was happening on the ground, was telling the U.S., you know, just not to do this. And this is being totally ignored. And I was called politically naive.
But we're talking about a number of different administrations.
Yeah.
But this is the permanent government was ignoring.
Yeah, yeah, and the information was there. The same with 2001, just before 9/11, Ahmad Shah Massoud warned that what the Al-Qaeda was doing. Abdul Haq, another highly influential former commander, also warned. And the Taliban were actually imploding at the time, and this was ignored.
Ahmad Shah Massoud, the head of the Northern Alliance, was killed just 2 days before September 11th, killed by al-Qaeda as a favor to the Taliban.
Yeah, I'd gone up to try and see Massoud for National Geographic, and I wanted to sit down with him and explore the past 20, 25 years of war, what made him continue. I couldn't see him because he couldn't make it. There were two men in the room next to me, both Middle Eastern reporters, supposedly, and these turned out to be the al-Qaeda agents who killed the suicide bombers.
So he didn't see you, but he saw the guys who killed him.
Right, and the only thing that really saved my life was the fact that my wife's birthday was on September 13th, and I had promised her to go back, and I did that, and that probably saved my life as well.
Has his significance been overblown? Would he have been the best thing for Afghanistan, or would he have just been another warlord?
I don't think he would have been a warlord. He had made some serious mistakes. He was an extremely competent commander, probably one of the greatest 20th century guerrilla strategists in the 20th century. However, he did have what was known as the Panjshir Mafia who came with him. They were corrupt. He lost a lot of credibility during the battle for Kabul. I think he would have made probably a good interlocutor. He didn't want to become a president, but I think both he and Abdul Haq, the leading Pashtun, who was also killed by Taliban a couple weeks later, they believed and they're trying to put together a broad alliance, including a lot of former Taliban. And that was the only way to do it. And they both warned not to bomb, because by bombing, you were creating new bin Ladens, but this time Afghan bin Ladens.
You saw the rise of the Taliban. Weren't they originally thought of as a stabilizing force for the country, including by the U.S. government?
Yes.
I remember the Wall Street Journal wrote an article saying, this is a great thing. Finally, we'll have some group that we can establish business ties with and work with.
The Taliban came out with a promise of law and order and security, and this is what most Afghans welcome. So, in fact, that's why they spread so quickly. However, being a Pashtun-dominated, a tribal-dominated movement, they very quickly began to repress other ethnic groups, such as the Shia Hazaras from the Central Highlands, the Tajiks in the north, the Uzbeks in the north, and popular resentment began to grow. But initially, they were saving grace. They would have brought security to Afghanistan.
Well, it seems no matter what you do, you cause popular resentment. The Taliban did, but they don't seem to go away, and they still have strong areas of support. And when the United States goes after them, we wind up causing resentment as well, perhaps because we don't always kill just the Taliban. We wind up killing women and children as well.
Well, today it's not just the Taliban. There are other insurgent groups and many tribesmen who are rebelling, and they're not part of the Taliban. You've got the Haqqani Network. You've got Hezbi Islami. So the insurgents are in it for various reasons. You know, a member of their family has been killed. Or, for example, the British in 2002, 2003, promised to compensate poppy farmers for the destruction of their crops, and they didn't. So this caused growing resentment. And now the
why didn't they?
I don't know. It's very strange.
I mean, it's bad to promise somebody
they
something.
They made promises.
It's going to wind up having a bad effect.
Yeah, the number of mistakes made by the Americans, by the British from 2001, 2002 onwards were extraordinary. I think a lot of people with experience from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, American, Europeans, Afghans, they all said, go slow, don't throw money at Afghanistan, and above all, don't get involved militarily. It's a complex country, you know, and it's got to be the Afghans themselves to do it. We can only help them. We can't do things for them.
My guest is Edward Girardet. His book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through Three Decades of War in Afghanistan, published by Chelsea Green. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. While Hamid Karzai became the leader of Afghanistan, he's gone from being a celebrated leader who was invited to the witness the State of the Union to be seen as a barrier to U.S. efforts to stop corruption and put his country on the right track.
Yeah, initially he was, as the Germans say, salon fait. He was someone you could present at parties. He spoke well. He looked great. However, his
family speaks English well.
Speaks English well, a key factor for Afghanistan. But basically, he and his family and members around him have become thoroughly corrupt. I mean, there's nothing about it, and everyone knows that.
His brother, who was recently killed, was at least alleged to be connected to the opium trade. But then again, so is the Taliban.
Yep, everyone is. I mean, it's big business. But also, military aid is big business. Humanitarian aid is big business as well. But the corruption goes not just within the Afghan government. It also goes amongst the companies. American, European have come in, these private contractors, who've basically, a lot of them have ripped off the taxpayer in many ways by incompetence, by taking massive overheads. And people wonder, you know, why on earth are these companies still getting contracts?
The Karzai government's new ambassador to Pakistan, Umar Dudzai, was on NPR's Morning Edition today, and he said that understanding the Taliban leadership is still a mystery. That doesn't sound promising. Is it still a mystery?
No, you have to go for individuals. And what's interesting, the aid agency has been working for many years in Afghanistan, including CARE International, which is based in Atlanta, the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan, the International Committee of the Red Cross. They talk with individuals. By putting labels on people, you're confusing things. So they look to the commanders they can talk to. And all these organizations work and talk with everyone. They talk with NATO. They talk with the insurgents. They talk with the local communities. And that's the only way to go. I think the upper echelons of the Taliban or these groups, one knows who they are, but they don't necessarily control the whole movement. They maybe influence certain parts of the country or certain elements of the insurgency. So it's a long-term process. You have to talk with everyone. That's what makes it so difficult.
Well, in the past, we talked about winning hearts and minds. And I wonder if the U.S. has been too quick to build roads, schools, and health clinics in Afghan villages without being able to get anything in return.
They made the mistake, and I think this has been the disastrous approach. They made the mistake of not talking to local communities. They wanted quick, you know, results. They had to show that things were being done. And an example of this is, for example, the road from Kabul to Kandahar, which was re-asphalted by a private contractor, instead of talking with local villagers, which might have taken months, lots of tea drinking, they went ahead and did it. The locals began to resent that because they saw the work going to other people, not to themselves.
So it wasn't a matter of building the road that everybody wanted. It was just a matter of how it was done?
Yeah, it was how it was done, and also the realization that you cannot do things quickly in Afghanistan.
But also, don't we often just misunderstand the culture? I saw a documentary in which the military built a park in the center of a village that's very much like what you would find in an American town. The villagers don't use it. They don't sit on the park benches. It is totally useless, and yet we thought we were doing them a favor.
Well, there are a lot of well-meaning initiatives, and I really feel sorry for a lot of the soldiers because they're expected to be soldiers and aid workers and development workers. It doesn't work that way. You have to involve the local community. You have groups like the Aga Khan Foundation who spend months talking to local communities, seeing what they need, what they want, and they make sure that if anything is done, that both sides contribute. You don't just go in there and build something. You involve the local community.
Well, everyone seems to come to Afghanistan with preconceived notions. Do we not understand what the Afghan people... Well, first of all, there are a whole bunch of different Afghan people, aren't there?
So it's a very diverse country, different groups, tribal groups, ethnic groups, and a lot of people think differently. When you go to one area, you just see that one area.
Why were we so reluctant on contractors rather than using the locals?
speed. I think people thought, well, we'll just go and do what we want. So we brought in warlords.
They'll appreciate it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, bringing in the same people that, who had lost credibility from before and putting them in power in 2002, 2003 was a huge mistake. Many Afghans who welcomed the Americans and the coalition interaction, they began to resent this. They realized that nothing had changed. It was all the same again.
Every time I read about the history of Afghanistan, the period before the government, the communist government, and even into the communist government, is described as a wonderful time. There was an enlightened king for a while. Women went to school. The country seemed to be on the road to some kind of almost maybe not Turkish secularism, but somewhere close to that. And now we have this country that is so totally different. Is it our fault?
I think it's the fault of the international community and Afghans themselves. I mean, a lot of Afghans who are benefiting now from all the money coming in, they're, you know, investing in properties in Dubai and London and Paris, New York, whatever. So a small group of privileged are doing very well. The ordinary Afghans wonder, where is all the aid going? What has this actually done to improve their lives? It hasn't done much. But the nostalgia for the past, whether real or not, is great.
Yeah, let's get back to Osama bin Laden for a moment. You ended up in a 45-minute debate with him, and you say you didn't even know who he was at the time?
No, no one knew who bin Laden was at the time, but he
was 1989?
Yeah, it was 89, February 89. It was at a time when, you know, the jihadists were coming in. A lot of these were foreign Islamic legionaries who came to Afghanistan in search of jihad. It was the only jihad going in the world.
So they didn't really care whether it was Afghanistan or anywhere else. It was just, hey, we got to go fight.
Yeah, that's why a lot of Afghans resented them. But like any Afghan, regardless which faction, you take aid or support from whoever gives it to you. So they tolerated the Arabs, but they didn't like them.
But the Arabs were also bringing in all sorts of customs that were, even though they were Saudi customs, they weren't Afghan customs.
They were very disparaging toward the Afghans. They said they're not proper Muslims. And, you know, this tall Arab, when he was talking to me, made this very clear to me, that they were there for jihad, a global jihad, not an Afghan jihad.
So I've been reading recently that there are all these rare earth minerals being discovered in Afghanistan. Do you think that might help the economy?
Yes, but it depends how it's done. Right now, the Chinese have invested in a huge copper mine. It's one of the largest in the world. But they're going to do it in a very Chinese way, bring in all their own people from drivers to, you know, gardeners and whatever.
Sounds like building the road from Kandahar
to
Kabul.
And they're doing this in Africa. And already there's resentment, also fear that this will have an environmental impact, pollution of the rivers and so on. But the Chinese do it their own way.
Well, we have a couple of problems here. We have Hamid Karzai's government being so corrupt. You've called the Afghan leadership wretched. Mm-hmm. So even if we were to win this war, what would we be winning?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's any possibility of winning the war. And, you know, no one's ever won a war in Afghanistan, not even the Afghans. So it's really a matter of what do you do with Afghanistan. And I think we need to go back to the basics of, say, 2001, 2002, and really start focusing on what works, what is realistic. And this certainly means not pouring in massive amounts of money. I mean, that was, again, one of those huge mistakes, trying to get everything done very quickly. And also by imposing a government from above rather than going from below.
When the United States invaded Iraq, many complained that it was diverting attention from Afghanistan, which was the serious problem. Now people are saying, as the 9/11 anniversary approaches, that we're focusing too much time and expense on Afghanistan when China should be our main concern.
Yeah, I mean, it's a regional problem as well, Afghanistan. But, you know, this focusing on the military and actually allowing generals to run the show in Afghanistan is a huge mistake, you know.
Well, President Obama announced this summer that he would withdraw the 33,000 troops in Afghanistan later this fall. But in today's newspaper, we hear that it probably will take a lot longer.
The hope is to train up the Afghan armed forces, the police. But the trouble is that most are illiterate. Many are northerners and not southerners. And also they're corrupt. And a lot of them have foot in both camps.
Does the death of Osama bin Laden change much on the ground in Afghanistan?
I don't think so.
So it's just a symbolic victory?
It's a symbolic. He's iconic. He's become the sort of the Che Guevara of Afghanistan, if you like. You see his posters around. But I think, you know, al-Qaeda was actually, as a movement, pretty much decimated.
Well, we are not about to leave Iraq, even though we're withdrawing troops. Do you think we'll ever leave Afghanistan?
I think probably one will. But the trouble is, by actually announcing it, one's undermining it, because now the approach of the insurgents is, even if things get harder for them, they are willing to wait now for 2014, and will probably do more operations, which has been the case, against civilian targets, against aid workers, against the military, to show that even if they are being harshly, you know, if the military operations, such as the drones, are killing commanders, that they will continue.
You don't live in the United States anymore?
I'm based in Geneva. I'm originally actually from New York, but I was one of these mongrels, you know, living in different parts of the world. No, I'm based in Geneva, and I actually quite like it there. I'm quickly in Asia, in Africa, and I think you're a bit closer to things.
Well, you have devoted a lot of your time to Afghanistan, so you know the country well. But what happens when you're parachuted into Angola? How much can you learn about a country when you go in to cover some immediate event?
Well, I think the media has changed a great deal in the way things are reported. I think the Afghan war was the last war, or the wars of the 80s were the last wars which were properly reported, because you couldn't just take a sat phone in with you. You couldn't just report. You had to go in, spend 3, 4, 6 weeks, and then you would come out. But it had, and then you'd file your reports. But it gave you the time to do proper reporting. Now, since the first Gulf War, people are parachuted in, and within, you know, 30 minutes, they're expected to give their first reports. So the actual legwork is not done properly. And I think that's one of the great drawbacks of modern reporting now.
Well, do you think that's been a big problem with Afghanistan? Because people come into the country to report without any real grounding in the history, without any real sense of all of the various tribal conflicts that are going on or could possibly go on?
There's some very good reporters, a lot of them freelancers covering Afghanistan, but a lot of the outside reporters that come in, they go in as embeds. And I think this is the danger, is that they see, you know, they'll have great stories about the boys at the front and girls at the front, but the thing is, they're not really understanding Afghanistan, because it's comfortable to cover with ISAF or NATO forces. You have food, you go to bed, you're driven elsewhere, but you don't really have the contact with the Afghans. And many will then leave. They'll cover the military story, but they don't have the Afghan perspective.
So do you speak Pashto?
I speak some Pashto and some Dari, yeah.
Edward Girardet's book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan, is published by Chelsea Green. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.